Here's a case where it really happened.
It's been a 50-year career that started with a sports-filled childhood.
I was shaped to be a sports fan.
His mom and grandmother were dedicated to giving him the love of sports that his late father no longer could.
I was 6 years old. My father had died the year before. She took me to a neighborhood party, put me in front of a TV dinner tray with a tiny television set on it and said, sit right here. And by the way, it's Sugar Ray Robinson versus Bo Olson for the middleweight championship of the world.
He's a sports broadcasting icon who ended up as a boxing commentator completely by accident and, yes, bad intentions.
The executive who first assigned me to call fights at ABC was doing it to get rid of me. He was so certain that I would not fit in that role.
Broadcasting legend, an amazing storyteller, Jim Lampley, and we got him now on The Pulse.
May I say you're great?
Thank you. Guys, welcome to another episode of The Pulse. You know the drill by now. Every week we're talking to people with amazing stories, inspiring stories, who are doing cool things. Realistically speaking, it's a show that just kind of allows me to talk to people that I always wanted to meet or had questions about. And our guest today is one of those people. I always hesitate to describe people as legends, Jim Lampley, because they don't always like that, you know. But I think that certainly in broadcasting and all the things that you have accomplished, Jim Lampley is in fact a legend. Network television, 14 Olympics, what else? Radio shows, Wide World of Sports, Monday Night Football, HBO Boxing, now a book, so many things. And it is my pleasure to have you join us. How are you, sir?
I'm good, and I have no constitutional objection to you describing me as a legend, regardless of how hyperbolic that may be.
Well, I appreciate it. I like going with it. I'm trying to remember, it was one of the comedians that we had on with us, and I described him as a legend, and he says it sounds like I was pushing him out the pasture, or I knew something about him that he didn't. He was like, he plans to still be here for a while. So I said, oh,
I would like to still be here for a while, too. But logic tells you it's not completely out of the range of possibility that I could drop dead tomorrow. 76 is, I think, pretty close to the average lifespan for an American male. So I kind of feel as though I'm playing with house money at this point. But, you know, who knows? This interview could last another 7 years.
Yeah, let's hope at least that. Now I feel bad about the legend label. I was like, oh, maybe I was suggesting negative things. But we do appreciate you taking some time with us. There's so much of a story. There's things that you're doing right now. But can we backpedal to give some of the background? Because how did you get into what has been this amazing journey?
So my father died when I was 5 years old. And my wife likes to point out all of your iconic stories begin with the words, my father died when I was 5 years old. It's the fundamental fact of my life, because it left me under the care of my double widowed mother, who was an extraordinarily brave, passionate woman from Memphis, Tennessee, and my grandmother, my father's mother, who lived to be 102 years old. And I was shaped throughout my life by 9 months a year in South Florida, where my mother was learning how to sell life insurance, and 3 months a year in my grandmother's kitchen in Hendersonville, North Carolina, watching her cook pound cakes for everybody else in Henderson County. And from them, I learned my family history. I learned all of the details of who my father was. And I was shaped to be a sports fan. Both of them realized and emphasized that if my father had lived rather than died when I was five, one of the things he most would have wanted was for me to be a fan and devotee of various sports. My mother added to that something very important in my ongoing progress, which was that regardless of my roots and regardless of how many grandparents and uncles and aunts could not properly pronounce the word Negro, that I would be an ardent devotee of equal rights for all people, of racial justice in the South where I was growing up, that I would be a fan of the civil rights movement. All of that ultimately coalesced with my early interest in boxing and the years that I spent alone in front of the television set watching Gillette Friday night fights and listening to Don Dunphy call fights, and ultimately my passionate love affair with one of the dominant public figures of my lifespan, Cassius Clay, who became Muhammad Ali. That was a huge through line in my life. It remains so to this day, and that helped to influence everything that has happened. That, along with the storytelling habit and storytelling acumen of both my mother and my grandmother. They talk to me all day long, every day. And, you know, in every story I tell, there's an echo of my grandmother or my mother in there. And that's true of my book as well.
You know, it's amazing because I was going right into that. And so all of that is true. Like, I read it was your mother who was taking you to sporting events. It was your mother who was committed to, and grandmother who was committed to making sure all of those things happen. I didn't read about your family commitment to equal rights, civil rights being kind of hammered into you at that point. But you were in a lot of ways kind of shaped, groomed, and trained for this career even before you knew it.
Well, the very first time my mother sat me down to watch a boxing match was 1955. I was 6 years old. My father had died the year before. She took me to a neighborhood party and walked me down a hallway to a guest bedroom, put me in front of a TV dinner tray with a tiny television set on it, and said, sit right here. You're going to be watching Friday night fights sponsored by Gillette. You're doing this because if your father was still alive, this is what he would be doing. Wow. And you would be doing it with him. And by the way, it's Sugar Ray Robinson versus Bobo Olson for the middleweight championship of the world. And pay particular attention to Sugar Ray Robinson. He's my favorite fighter because he dances when he fights. I was not old enough at that moment to understand the full import of my mother, a product of a poor Irish household in Memphis, Tennessee, whose parents were just as maladept at pronouncing the word Negro as my paternal grandparents were. And for her to be telling me that her favorite fighter was Sugar Ray Robinson and that he danced while he fought was an early piece of evidence that I ultimately put together with a lot of other things to understand what her attitudes were, and still wonder to this day, how did she develop them? How did she come to that point of view when everything around her would have predicted the opposite point of view? But it was hugely important to me. And one thing I always say at this moment is, I don't know how anybody could have begun a network television sports commentary career at age 25 in 1974 as I did, and then continued to grow and polish that career through the 70s, 80s, 90s, into the 21st century, if he had a different attitude toward race, if he had been schooled to be against racial progress. I don't see how you would have done that, particularly in the world of boxing, where my passion for Muhammad Ali continued and was proliferated all along the way, where I wound up working with Roy Jones, Emanuel Stewart, George Foreman. Emanuel Stewart became the closest male adult friend I ever had. None of that would have happened if I had been trained into a different attitude toward race than the one into which my mother trained me.
Was that ever, and I mean, we're kind of going back through your history and your background, but I was that challenging? Because you say you don't imagine how people could develop that, the opposite mindset, but plenty did. And if you were standing out there and having that level of passion, those level of friendships, you know, standing up for people as you called the sports in an environment that didn't always welcome that. Was that ever a challenge for you, kind of carrying out what it seems was an early and clear passion?
Let me answer a question with a question. Did I argue tooth and nail? Were there verbally violent battles with my aunts and uncles and, yes, even my beloved grandparents in Hendersonville? Mm-hmm. Yes, they were. I was the family gadfly. And, you know, people had to either put up with it or challenge me back. And for, you know, a few years in my teenage years in particular, they definitely did challenge me back. And every time I went home to Miami and described to my mother what was going on, she would say, stand your ground, fight them, just as you are doing, because you are right and they are wrong. And that was what strengthened me and kept me in line with my spine, as I like to say, all the way through that adolescent experience. Did I love my grandparents? Desperately. Did I love my aunts and uncles? They were the Lampleys. Of course I did. But at the end of the day, on that one particular subject and all the politics that surrounded it, I fought them, and I fought them passionately because of my mother's attitudes and beliefs. And again, I have no idea where she got it.
You know, I'm listening because there's a lot of, and I'm fascinated by and impressed by, there's not a lot of people who are such well-respected, decorated journalists where nobody would ever argue whether or not they are a journalist, but also so passionate about the fact that these many of these people you were covering and working with were friends, you know, were people you looked up to, were people you developed relationships with. Was that ever a challenge? I am a journalist who is doing this job, but yeah, I like these people. Yeah, I respect these people. Yeah, I'm sitting next to someone and calling fights with someone who I view as a friend.
Well, in sports, you are always splitting the difference between passionate allegiance, the fan experience, the things that you love about those sports, and then the concrete realities that also exist in the sports world, the business conditions, the personnel conditions, the decisions that are made about how people are deployed, et cetera. So it was a constant path through which I was finding my way, and inevitably my that element, the way my mother trained me with regard to race, inevitably that was going to be in some way a part of it. Did Roy Jones and Emmanuel Stewart and George Foreman sitting next to me shoulder to shoulder in announced positions chemically gather and understand who I was in that regard? I hope so. I hope that was part of what those friendships were all about, because they were great and meaningful friendships for me. As I said, Emmanuel Stewart was the closest male adult friend I ever had in my life. When George Foreman died 3 weeks ago, I cried. And there's an extremely iconic picture in my family of Muhammad Ali babysitting my 8-year-old daughter, my eldest daughter, at the United States Boxing Writers Association dinner 1 year back in the late 80s. And so, you know, all of these things ultimately came to personal contact fruition. They weren't just theoretical for me after a while. They were early on, when the only black people I knew were the ones in Hendersonville. By the way, I moved to Miami expecting to see a more open and tolerant racial environment. Couldn't have been more wrong. If anything, black people were just as persecuted in Miami in the 1960s as they were in North and South Carolina. I was startled to see that. But, you know, that's my view of America. And my mother was constantly shaping me and pushing me to say, the future, not the past. You're a part of the future, not the past.
I read in doing research for this interview that talking to you is a series of amazing stories and kind of behind the scenes interaction and things that many of us would never have seen if we were just watching you cover the different events. Some of them, like you share some of the stories. And I see that very quickly. But your book, It Happened, A Uniquely Lucky Life in Sports Television, it's only been out now for what, like a couple weeks?
Right.
And out there, I already saw top-selling sports on Amazon and all that, so congratulations. But why? Why'd you decide to, after this much time, share all of these stories and stuff that you've kind of been sharing with people when you sit down and talk to them for years?
Well, it was a sort of what next decision. I, you know, came to a fork in the road that seemed at that moment to be the end of my boxing television commentary career. And as I was assessing what next for that, I had a lunch, fundraising lunch in Los Angeles with the chancellor of my alma mater, the University of North Carolina, and the chair of the communications department, a brilliant woman named Patricia Parker. And they kind of casually during that lunch, which was a fundraising lunch, brought up the question of, well, you know, have you ever thought about teaching? And I said, yes, absolutely. I have it in the back of my mind that I would love to come back and teach at Carolina. And the chair of the communications department smiled and said, Jim, if you want to come and stand in a classroom in Chapel Hill and talk about your career, your background, your past, anything you want to talk about, we'll call that a course. So
love it. I'd take that course.
So I came back and I wasn't satisfied with that. I created what I thought of as a genuinely academic course. I told Dr. Parker, I said, what I'd really like to do is create a course that will stay in the curriculum and somebody else will teach it after I'm finished. The title of the course was Evolution of Storytelling in American Electronic News Media. Dr. Parker asked me, what do you really want to talk about? I said, I want to talk about truth. I want to talk about how truth is treated in electronic news media, how it's curated, what protects it, which media are kind to truth, which media aren't, etc. That's really what I want to talk about. The course was historical in base. It was Edward R. Murrow. It was Walter Cronkite. It was Huntley and Brinkley. It was all the things that had gone into the development of our current news environment. Ultimately, it got to Watergate and the importance of news media behavior and curating and promoting the truth at the time of the Watergate situation. And I taught it for five semesters, and I stopped teaching at the moment when I thought that my students were no longer listening. And the reason that they were no longer listening was an extremely pernicious thing called social media.
Yes.
I am pretty much the number one anti-social media advocate you will find in the public space. And I told my students over and over, if you wake up in the morning and you want to get your first dose of news on what's happening in the world from your preferred social media feed, you're asking to be colonized, you're asking to be subdivided, you're asking to be separated, you're asking to be proselytized. Eventually, you are asking to be denied the truth. They wouldn't listen to me. And after a couple semesters of that and realizing increasingly that they weren't going to listen to me, I said, okay, I've had enough. There are other things to do in Chapel Hill, and now I will do them. And I had a friend here named Art Chansky who had written or participated in 10 or 11 books. And he said, I can make your autobiography easy. I'll be your as told to author. I know how to deal with publishers. I can help you do this. So I sat down with my friend Art Chansky and began shaping and creating my autobiography titled It Happened. And as you know, Bill, the title comes from my call of George Foreman's never to be forgotten knockout of Michael Moore to become the oldest heavyweight champion in history. It plays directly off of the fact that George and I were friends and colleagues at that point. It Happened, which was my commentary response that night, was actually a direct response to him because of what he had told me would happen, because he had just made happen exactly what he told me and what I didn't believe he could do. I didn't believe he could shape Michael Moore into the knockout victim he became. I didn't believe he could become heavyweight champion again at age 45, but he did. It happened.
You know, one thing I will respectfully take issue with, I think that you would be a fascinating social media follow. And so, and I understand the frustration with social media. I share it in a lot of circumstances and have largely gotten involved with it much more out of need, you know, in my current position than the fact that I wake up, you know, necessarily wanting to do it. But I think that these types of stories that you're sharing, we need more of. You know, I think the way that you counter that.
Here's your kind of left-handed or off-handed gift in that regard. The book has put me on social media.
Nice.
There is now a a site or an identity called The Real Jim Lampley. I don't even know exactly which medium it is on. I think it might be Instagram. But my wife, Deborah, and my daughters have all bonded together to shape The Real Jim Lampley. The Real Jim Lampley is a tremendous platform for promoting the book. So now, despite my chemical resistance, I am in social media, and you can share in that any day.
And I will tag you with clips from this interview on social media, and together we will go viral and change the face of what people are criticizing on social.
I already love you desperately, Bill.
When you look
that engenders.
When you look back on the career, and I'd imagine writing the book in some ways kind of forces you to do that. Like, you're putting all of this down, so you go back and reflect on things that have happened over the year. Do you ever allow yourself to kind of sit back and go, whoa, like every major sporting event over the last however many years, in some capacity, Olympics and championships and boxing and sport, you played some sort of a role in. Now, do you get a chance to sit back and go, okay, like, well done. I'm happy with how this has turned out.
It happened. I think the breadth of my career, the variety of my career, the ups and downs of my career, the way certain perceived failures led to things that could be seen as triumphs, the various different responses of all the networks that I worked for to the things that I said and did. I think all of that makes for a broad, rich, amazing Dostoevskian type story. Am I more likely to focus when I look back on my failures and mistakes and the ways in which I altered the path negatively rather than positively? Yeah, I mostly am. But am I also in some instances prompted to sit back and marvel, oh my God, look at the luck you had, look at the people you worked with, look at the things you saw and did? Yes, that too. The two things I love most about the book are my description of Franz Klammer's downhill at Innsbruck in 1976, my very first Olympics, the first Olympic event that I ever attended, and my accidental visit to the Miracle on Ice 1980 in Lake Placid. And the thing that I like best about both of them is that they weren't supposed to happen. I was not supposed to be at Klammer's downhill. I was sent there on a whim by the executive producer at the last minute, and I was absolutely not supposed to be at the Miracle on Ice. I was sent there by the great Rune Arledge because in his golden gut instinct for when something unusual and extremely high profile was going to happen, he had a hunch after the first period, after Mark Johnson scored the goal that made it 2-2, he had a sudden inner inspiration, something wild is going to happen here. And he called me in an edit bay and said, what are you doing? And I told him, and he said, stop doing that. Go to the hockey arena. We need you to find the right interview with which to close the telecast this evening. And I did. So those are my two favorite anecdotes in the entire book, because they were not planned. They were not part of some predestined assignment that was mine because I was me. They were things that happened accidentally and organically because the people who were working with me knew that I was capable of responding to unusual moments, and I did.
Some of that plays directly into it happened, right? A uniquely lucky life. So with all of the talent, the skill.
I did not know the night that Foreman knocked Moorer out that I was going to title my autobiography right in response to that. But once I said those words in that situation, going forward year to year to year, if I ever thought about writing a book and I thought about what would be the title, it was always one of the top three choices. And once we got to the point of doing the book, it was clear that that was really the only choice to describe the nature of my life and my career.
So you really do humbly embrace this as obviously a talent, but a lucky journey as well.
All luck. Well, no, not all luck. People bristle against that. How can you call it all luck? You had the talent. You did all the things that you do. And I always start with, all right, okay, you want to say that I wasn't lucky. If you are the one person chosen from a 432 candidate talent hunt in 1974 to become the first person ever to stand on the sideline of a football game with a camera and a microphone, and you know clearly that you are the one person among the 432 who least fits all of the descriptive elements and the credentials of what they said they were looking for, you have to regard yourself as lucky. I was not supposed to be among the field of candidates for that particular job. I did not fit the criteria. And ultimately, I was the one who was chosen for the reason that they said would not be the choice, which was my experience on camera and with microphones. I had broadcasting experience prior to that talent hunt. They had always said they were going to take a diamond in the rough, somebody who had no broadcasting experience. At the last minute, Rune Arledge got cold feet and said, hey, did we talk to anybody who's actually proven something in front of a camera and a microphone? And his assistant, Dick Ebersole, said, yeah, there was one. And the evaluation form from the initial screening interview said arrogant, abrasive, antagonistic, alienated. Wow. That became known in the football truck as the four A's. Every time I was difficult or obstreperous about something, the director, Andy Sedaris, would say, the four A's, there they are, right there. Arrogant, abrasive, alienated, antagonistic. I went on from there to build a 50-year career.
I'm going to embrace this whole lucky thing. Like, you had some or divine intervention or something along the line, because I agree with you the way you tell that story. That wasn't in theory supposed to happen. There are at least one more thing that we need to talk about. So with all of this career, the book is kind of talking about a reflection and looking back in your life. But you're gonna do this again. May 2nd. Calling fights, big fights, Ryan Garcia, Teofilo Lopez, Devin Haney. With so much on your resume and so many amazing moments, why? Why do you want to keep doing it?
Because I'm a boxing blow-by-blow person. And, I committed myself to learning and embracing that role over a 31-year period, beginning on ABC and proceeding on to HBO. And again, it happened. Why that title? The executive who first assigned me to call fights at ABC was doing it to get rid of me. He was so certain that I would not fit in that role, that viewers would not accept me in that role. He had no idea that the first sports event my mother had ever sat me down to watch when I was 6 years old was a boxing match between Sugar Ray Robinson and Bo Olson. He thought that I was a complete misfit in boxing, and that was going to force me out the door. What he ultimately succeeded in doing was writing me a ticket to HBO, the number one purveyor of boxing television in the world at that moment. So it happened. You know, you cannot explain these defiant facts in any other way to say that this guy was incredibly gifted idiosyncratically by the universe and given things that no one knew he deserved or could live up to. Boxing commentary is number one on that list. And therefore, I have a chance to return to being a blow-by-blow person. Over the long haul, that became who I am, and I'm proud of it, and I want to front it one more time.
I love those stories. The people who think that they're doing something to get rid of you, the suits, the decision makers, and nope, you're not going to put me down. I will go ahead and take that, turn with it, and turn it into the Hall of Fame career. That's amazing.
The man who made that decision wound up sitting in my control room for hundreds of hours of Olympic broadcasting when I was the late night and or the cable host for NBC's Olympics coverage. He sat in my control room after having tried to obliterate my career, and every day I would say, good morning, Dennis, and every night I would say, good night, Dennis. And, you know, that's just a classic lesson in life in broadcasting in America. The same fools you meet on the way up, you're going to see them again on way down.
And some of those fools need to remember that when they're making some of those foolish decisions. We have limited time, so I want to make sure we cover everything, and I appreciate you spending this much time with us. It happened, now out. Obviously, it is a strong recommendation, hopefully, from our conversation and your experience, that people will get this and more, right? The lifetime of stories in that book.
Well, I mean, look, I'm proud of the book. The book is a tribute to my mother and my grandmother. I have told you who they were and how they helped to shape my life. My wife asked me several weeks ago, you know, how is it that you start these stories and go off on some tributary into left field and seem to have left the original subject behind, and then there's some curve around the bend and you come back to where you were, etc. How do you do that? I said, that's exactly the way my mother and grandmother told stories. I'm just listening to what I already heard in my head and reproducing it in my own words. And so I'm proud of the book because it's me. I think it fairly, faithfully, and honestly tells my stories. I don't shy away from my failures. I don't shrink from celebrating what became my successes. I attribute that more to the judgment of other people than to anything I did. Was I capable of doing what I was doing? Most of the time, yes.
Two more questions, then I know we've got to go ahead and wrap up. We've talked about It Happened, that call. We've talked about hockey gold medal and that interview. Anything else that jumps out at you as, yeah, they're some of the ones I'm most proud of?
14 Olympics. I'm not the person who does the counting, but to this day, I am told that that is the largest number of Olympics assignments for any American broadcaster. And the friendships I have and retain to this day. I mean, I'm very proud just of the blurbs on my cover: Bob Costas, Billie Jean King, John Grisham, who is hosting an event with me at the bookstore here in Chapel Hill tonight. Forward by Taylor Sheridan, probably the hottest television writer in the world right now. Not probably, the hottest television writer in the world. How did you get a forward by Taylor Sheridan? Well, we met. He's a massive boxing fan. He sat down and did what amounted to an encyclopedic interview with me about boxing. We became instant friends. The next time I saw him, he said, "What are you doing?" I said, "I'm writing my autobiography." And he said, "Well, I hope I'm writing the foreword." I said, "Taylor, I was going to ask you for a cover blurb. I don't want to write a cover blurb. I want to write the foreword." So all of these things happened. Okay, you could not have predicted that my book was going to have a foreword by Taylor Sheridan. You couldn't have predicted that my book was going to have a cover blurb by John Grisham. 2 years ago, I didn't even know him. But again, all these things have fallen into place. And oh, by the way, the worst and most painful of these things is that George Foreman died 3 weeks ago. Yeah. The title comes from my call of his win over Michael Moore. The prologue, the first thing you read in the book after the foreword, is about the 19-year-old me watching the 19-year-old Foreman win his gold medal in Mexico City and what that meant to me at that time. His most iconic rivalry was with my longtime childhood hero, Muhammad Ali. The most memorable line in the book, by the way, which a lot of people have said to me is the most memorable line of the book, is my recitation of what I call the greatest line of boxing commentary ever. The greatest line of boxing commentary ever, in my view, was uttered by my friend and acquaintance, Mick Jagger. The night that Larry Holmes was beating up Muhammad Ali in a necessary rite of passage that had to take place in the heavyweight division, and I felt a little poke in my rib cage in a secluded conference room in the ABC building in New York, where I was watching the fight with a select Rune Arledge handpicked crowd, and I looked over, and the person who had poked my rib cage was Mick, and he said, "Lamps, do you know what we're watching?" And I said, "No, Mick, what are we watching?" "It's the end of our youth." That is the greatest line of boxing commentary ever, and it can never be topped. It was early in round 10 when the fight was eventually stopped. It was torturous to watch what Holmes was able to do and was doing to Ali at that point. And Mick says, "It's the end of our youth." Perfect, right on target, and I'm glad I remembered it for my book.
We end every episode of The Pulse with the theme of the show. The theme is using your voice for good. So I ask everyone, when they hear the phrase, use your voice for good, what does that mean to you?
Well, it means to me to use my voice to observe the best of my character and not the worst of my character. I have character flaws like anybody else. I can be selfish, petty, mean-spirited like anybody else, even to my daughters, even to my mother when she was alive. So I'm human. I fail sometimes in terms of personal character. And yes, because I have an expressive voice, which has reached out to certain pockets of the American culture, I need to be very careful to use it for good purposes and to promote the best parts of the human spirit, not the worst.
Jim Lampley, I appreciate you taking this much time. We will see you on TV calling fights. We will be looking forward to finishing It Happened, a uniquely lucky life in sports television. Continued success. We will continue to follow your career and follow you on social media.
Thank you very much, Bill. Look forward to the next time. And yes, social media, the real Jim Lampley. I think it's Instagram, but it's very characteristic of Jim Lampley not to know for certain which of the media he's involved in.
We will find it. Thank you so much. I appreciate your time.
All right. Talk to you later.
All right. You have a good one. Guys, thanks so much for listening to The Pulse with Bill Anderson podcast. Today with legendary announcer, sports play-by-play guy, Jim Lampley, now also with a really cool book. It's just fun hearing those stories and giving him the time to actually share what was going on behind the scenes when we were watching all of these historic events. I absolutely enjoyed it. Hope you did as well. Do me a favor, hit like, subscribe, follow, whatever it is you have to hit on your screen so you get a notification every week when The Pulse with Bill Anderson comes out. You can also download the Fox Local app. So all of our shows, well over 100 episodes, are right there at your fingertips. Take them with you on your tablet, phone, computer, whatever, and watch some really cool guests. And also hit me up on social media at BillAFox29. I am always eager to hear from you. Thank you so much for listening, and I leave you today as I always do, reminding you whenever you can, use your voice for good and have a good one.